Good afternoon.
I believe that you will agree Pakistan and Afghanistan are among the most difficult foreign policy challenges that the U.S. faces, both now and in the future. The social, economic, and political dynamics that are at play there are certainly daunting. And when the U.S. pulls out of Afghanistan this end of this year, the situation will be more complicated. To give us a perspective on all of this and of the region, I can't think of a better person to do it than Shuja Nawaz. I had the pleasure of working with Shuja at the IMF, where he played an important role in the fund's external relations department, eventually serving as the editor of the Finance and Development magazine, a quarterly periodical that the bank and the IMF publish quarterly. Shuja comes from a distinguished military family in Pakistan, which gives him a unique perspective on the long internal struggle between the military and civil authorities there. And clearly, in seeking that stabilization, I am in the process of reading his book, and I would like to plug it because it is a marvelous book talking about this struggle. It's called Cross Swords. Shuja was educated at Gordon College, Rawalpindi, where he obtained a BA in economics and in English literature. He continued his studies, attending the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University in New York. Shuja is a seasoned journalist, an accomplished author, and a political and strategic analyst who writes for the leading newspapers and websites and speaks on topics for civic groups and on radio and television worldwide. I know you're going to be in for a treat. I think you'll find his insights and thoughts provoking and insightful. And please welcome Shuja Nawaz.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you very much, Bruce, for that wonderful introduction and the warm welcome. It's an honor to be here. It's a great privilege, I think, to be before an audience with so much experience and knowledge that I wonder if I can really add to your knowledge, but I will do my best. As Bruce has already alluded, the transitions that are occurring in the region that my center covers are really momentous. And despite the events that are currently taking place in Syria or in the Middle East or in the Ukraine or the Crimea, the great game that has been played over the centuries will continue to be played in the region that I cover. And I say this not because I'm director of the South Asia Center, but you should know that when we launched the center at the Atlantic Council in 2009, I persuaded our president, Fred Kemp, that it should cover not just geographic South Asia, but also include the Gulf states, Iran, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. And I said this because historically, culturally, politically, these are countries that have always been tied together. And what happens there is going to affect not just that region, but the world. You just look at the countries that are in the region as well as their neighboring countries. You look at India, you look at Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan, and the Central Asian states, and then you look at their proximity to China and Russia, and of course to the Middle East and the Arabian Peninsula. You can't but help notice that almost anything and everything that deals with the global economy or global politics involves countries in that region. And what they do or don't do will affect the future path of, of global economics and politics. So it's in that context that for the last year, everywhere that I've spoken, I've talked of the couple of years of transition. There was the election in Iran that serves as a precursor to the transitions that are taking place now in the region. There was the election that took place in Pakistan, the first time ever in the 66 years now of the country's life when there was a peaceful transition from one elected civilian government to another civilian government, and the new government is elected with a pretty strong majority and a strong mandate, so there's hope for some stability there. And then, of course, the elections that are now taking place in early April in Afghanistan as well as in India. In India, particularly, it's an election that is likely to produce tremendous change. When the Congress Party, which has been in power for a very long time and which is the party of the dynasty that founded the government in India at the time of independence in 1947, is likely to lose big this time and be replaced by an opposition party, the BJP, most likely, although we won't know. I will be there for the elections, and so I'll be watching this in Afghanistan and in India very closely. And if the news media want, then you might be hearing my voice or seeing my face from the region, depending on the situation. So these are the last two elections in the region that will play a role in the shape of things to come. I should also mention that a big transition took place in China with the election of a new president and a new leadership. And so that whole region of the world is now going to be under new leaders, and it offers not just a challenge but a huge opportunity for the people of the region as well as for us in the United States to craft a new set of stable, long-term relations. Now, when looking at the post-2014 Afghanistan, we have to make an assumption that there will be an election, and most likely there will be, that the elections will be generally free and fair. And again, my assumption is they will be because of the changes that have occurred in Afghanistan, and I will talk a little bit about that. But also, as we go forward, we're going to see the transition of relationships among the countries of the region. So I will talk a little bit about the regional impact of these changes, because it's not just a simple one-to-one relationship between either the United States and Afghanistan or the U.S. and Pakistan or Pakistan and Afghanistan or Pakistan and India. I call this a multivariate equation. There are many different parts. They all have to work together. And if we are smart, we are going to be able to use, for the first time in history, a strategic relationship that the United States has with Afghanistan, with Pakistan, and with India to effect the kind of changes that will put all that region on the path of stability. Now, just a few words of introduction about the work that I do, because that will put this all in perspective and why I say some of the things with a certain level of confidence, because of the work that my colleagues and I have done on this in the last 5 years. The South Asia Center runs an Iran task force. We have, since we are a bipartisan organization, the Atlantic Council, we had the task force under then-Senator Chuck Hagel and Stu Eisenstadt. So we had a Democrat and a Republican. Then Chuck Hagel got a better offer and moved on to become Secretary of Defense. And so Stu Eisenstadt has been running things. We have now acquired Governor John Huntsman as our new chairman at the Atlantic Council. And I don't think one could have looked for a smarter person in politics to join us. And I'm trying to persuade him now to become the co-chair of the Iran task force. So on Iran, we've been working to build a relationship between the United States and between Europe and Iran, but also to build it based on knowledge and education, so that we understand how Iran views its position, and they understand how we view them and how we can and will use sanctions to prevent them from becoming a nuclear weapons state. I'm very pleased to say that we've played a small role in this engagement by arranging background meetings between people and by meeting with Iranian leaders ourselves. Bruce was mentioning my experience, at the IMF. One of the good things I did with help from the IMF was to take a leave of absence and work at the International Atomic Energy Agency as a director with Mohammad al-Baradei. And this was the period during which I came to know the Iranian permanent representative there, who just recently retired as the foreign minister of Iran. So we had a relationship there that we could build on, and we now have a relationship with the new Iranian foreign minister, where he feels confident in talking to us. We feel confident in saying very candid and blunt things to him that he can carry back to his people. And so a conversation really was begun on Iran, which is affecting the region. And this is big for what will happen in Afghanistan, because Iran has a role in Western Afghanistan. They have very close economic ties, they have social, political ties, and cultural ties, and that's also the portion which is very Shia-dominated. And so the Iranian people and the people of Western Afghanistan are very close. We also have been following the events between India and Pakistan in a big way. So we've been launching Track 2 dialogues. These are non-official dialogues between India and Pakistan between the military, which was the first time ever, on water issues, and we can talk about that in the questions and answers, I'm sure, as well as on trade and business. Because I believe that in the end, everything revolves around economics. And if we can get the business communities in India and Pakistan to work together, they will not only open their own borders, but they will also open the borders into Afghanistan and through Afghanistan into Central Asia. And when that happens, everyone comes out a winner. It's no longer a zero-sum game. And that has been our quest, to try and persuade people that it is not a zero-sum game, that you will all benefit, and maybe some will benefit more initially, others are going to benefit more later on, but everybody comes out ahead. It's very critical to look at trade patterns in that respect, and so we've been looking at trade as well as security. And if you look at pipelines, currently the Chinese have been making huge inroads into Central Asia, because they want the pipelines to go east. They need the energy. India will need every ounce of energy that it can get from Central Asia. And the only way it can get that is through Afghanistan and through Pakistan. So if we can open those borders, open it for trade and transit, the U.S. has already done a lot. The U.S. arbitrated between Afghanistan and Pakistan in setting up a transit trade agreement for Afghan goods to flow into Pakistan, but they stop at the Indian border. And so we now have to find a way of making that a seamless crossing and bring India into the picture. And so that's what we are working on. Now, in terms of Pakistan itself, it remains a very key country because of its strategic location. This was the reason why the United States set up a relationship with Pakistan soon after it became independence. And they basically supplanted the British as the key foreign power that was interested in that part of the world. And at that time, the binding force was communism. So Pakistan, having a modern, highly disciplined army trained by the British, was to serve, along with Turkey, as a bulwark against Soviet aggression. It was to prevent the Soviets from moving into Iran or to take the Iraqi oil fields at that time. Pakistan, of course, was worried about India to the east. It was concerned that India, which was 4 or 5 times its size in military might, want to undo the independence or the partition of Pakistan from British India in 1947. And It wanted to strengthen its defenses on the east. Now, this became a very interesting relationship between consenting adults. Each one had his own dreams. And in fact, a favorite quote of mine is from Professor Rifat Hussain from Pakistan, who said it's like a couple who sleeps in the same bed but dreams different dreams. The U.S. and Pakistan became like that. Another interesting narrative that informs this relationship is one of mistrust and change, constant change. The Pakistani general and dictator, General Ziaul Haq, who became the favorite of the West because he was the go-between for the fight against the Soviets after they invaded Afghanistan, described to his ambassador in Washington, Jamshed Marker, the relationship with the United States. He said, being a friend of the United States is like living on the banks of a great big river. Every 4 years, the river changes course, and you're either left flooded or high and dry. So there's a kind of fatalistic view of this relationship. Now, many of you have probably heard also about the Pew polls. They take place every year. The last few years, they've been going to Pakistan and asking people about how they view themselves and their relationship with the United States. Now, Pew also does polling in the United States, and many of you may have been called for that. And what they do is they pair the countries around the world, and they tell you, this is what the French think of us, this is what we think of the French. Well, for Pakistan, it's interesting. 82% of Americans, roughly, think that Pakistan is not to be trusted. And in Pakistan, when they ask this question, something like 60% or more of Pakistanis think that the Americans are their biggest enemy, even bigger enemy than potentially than India. So there's a kind of fear that pervades this relationship. But what is fascinating for me, because I follow these polls, is a question that is asked, which is, do you want better relations with the United States? Consistently, and despite the ups and downs in this relationship, 6 out of 10 Pakistanis throughout the years that the question has been asked have said they would like better relations with the United States. And so my advice to Pew has been, you need to unpack that. Unpack why 6 out of 10 Pakistanis want a better relation. What is it about the U.S. that they find attractive? And how can we strengthen the positive rather than the negative in this relationship? Now, I'm an optimist. And I often quote my friend Arno de Burgrave from CSIS, who tells me that a pessimist is an optimist with experience. But I still feel that you have to be an optimist to do the work that I do and to get up every morning and open my computer and hope that the worst has not happened. And so I believe that if you look for the positive elements and if you look for that longer-term view that brings the countries together, that you can overcome the short-run ups and downs. As I said earlier, there's a huge narrative and a history to this relationship, particularly the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. And if you were to chart it, as I've done, and you look at financial flows, and I know many of you are in the world of finance, it's almost like the Dow Jones. It kind of goes up and down and up and down. It's a very jagged relationship. I call it a roller coaster relationship. And if on top of that chart from 1947 till now, you superimpose the types of government that have existed in Pakistan, you will find that we tend to support Pakistan the most when there is a military ruler or an autocratic ruler in Pakistan. And the reason for that is been explained among others by Henry Kissinger, because when you deal with those people, they get things done for you. But in my view, in my humble view compared to Henry Kissinger's view, this is a short-term approach. You really need to have a longer-term view, and you need to build relationships with the people of the country that you want to get to know. The good news is that there are people in Washington today that are supporting that. There are people on the Hill that were farsighted enough to come up with the Kerry Lugar Berman bill. And even though that's not a huge amount of money, it's $7.5 billion over 5 years, which is not a lot for a country the size of Pakistan with its 200 million people, it certainly showed an intention of having a longer-term relationship. And now I work very closely with the Department of State, with the White House, with DOD, in building people-to-people contacts. And there is so much support and enthusiasm for these. For instance, we have a young leaders program from Pakistan where we bring 15 emerging leaders, men and young women, average age 26. They come for 3 weeks to the U.S., they go back and they tell us, oh, I never thought the U.S. was like this. I'd never met an American, you know, an ordinary American. We just hear the diplomats and we see people on TV. And we take them to 4 different cities. They have homestays in places like Kansas City. They get to meet people. They get to do things. And they learn. And they network. And then their American contacts help them develop their activities when they go back. That's the kind of relationship that I think builds a future partnership. Not, you know, we give you money and you do this for us. On money, we have, since 2002, and this is after the invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. has given Pakistan a little over $27 billion of either direct or indirect assistance. The indirect assistance includes something called coalition support funds. These are monies that are given to the Pakistanis to reimburse them for the expenses that they've incurred in bringing 150,000 troops to the western border with Afghanistan and to try and seal that border. Now, I've traveled that border, and it's impossible to seal. Others that have dealt with it know it's impossible to seal, but that's the cost of doing business. However, the peak of this assistance was reached in 2010 fiscal year. That's in the past. That was when something like $4.6 billion was given in that year to Pakistan. In the current 2013 fiscal year, only $1.1 billion is going to Pakistan. Next year, only $882 million will go. So we're already on the glacis, the downward slope on the other side of the hill. And we have to be prepared for other interaction and to improve the human contact if we're going to go forward. Very interesting figures for you. Something like 200-plus officers from the Pakistan military are now being trained in the United States. So every year, 200 or more officers come here. And the Pakistanis, interestingly, send their very best to the United States. They don't send them to China or Iran or Saudi Arabia or other places for training and experience. They select the best. And I follow these people when they come here, and I follow them when they go back. Interestingly, almost all the people that come here get promoted as soon as they get back because they've been put on the fast track. They've been identified as future leaders in the Pakistan military. What I'm suggesting to the Pentagon now is that they should increase this number by multiples and bring younger officers and non-commissioned officers so that they can not only do courses here, but they should also serve with U.S. troops. When you command troops, you serve with them, you get to know them, you build relationships that will then last for generations. They will keep up with each other. And that's the way to do it, doing more with less. You know, just up the road from us here at Tampa, Jim Mattis was the CENTCOM commander, and just before he left, he put together a team that looked at the future of CENTCOM, and the title was Doing More with Less. And this was the one idea that I presented, which they are going to now try and implement. And I think it will need that kind of smart thinking on our part so that we break this chain of mistrust. But it will take time. It's not going to change overnight. It will not change with this government in Pakistan. It won't change with this administration in Washington. Now, with Afghanistan, it's very critical that the Afghan-Pakistan relationship is brought into the picture. This is an old relationship, and there's a lot of suspicion on the part of Pakistan that India, which is a larger regional power, has invested over $1 billion in Afghanistan, that India wants to sandwich Pakistan somehow. That's the wrong view. The other view in the past was that the Pakistanis should support the Pakhtun, because they are the largest single tribal group in Afghanistan, and also because there are more Pakhtun in Pakistan than in Afghanistan. So they want that relationship to continue. Over time, I think Pakistan has to stop thinking about Afghanistan and seeing it only through the Pakhtun prism. I don't know how many people realize this here or even in Pakistan, and that is surprising to me, that Afghanistan was a country much before India or Pakistan became a country, that it has a boundary and it has a system whereby different ethnic groups have lived with each other, worked with each other. The Taliban upset that system. We upset it further by going in and trying to create a strong central government in Kabul that really destroyed the ability of different parts of the country to work with each other. Everything was then controlled from Kabul. That doesn't work in a country that doesn't have the mechanisms. You need to devolve responsibility to the local levels. It is a mixture of a tribal system, but it's also a very modernized system. The big change that we will see as you look at the elections is what happens to the voting patterns. You have, in Afghanistan, the youngest population in all of South Asia. We work with the National Intelligence Council at the Atlantic Council, and the last report we worked with them was a 2030 scenario and forecast. And by 2030, Afghanistan will be the only country in that part of the world that will actually have a youth dividend, a bigger youthful population than an older population. And we have to keep that in mind. The other big change in Afghanistan that will play a role in this election is that it is now largely an urban country. Afghanistan has large cities. Kabul, which used to have a few thousand people at one time. I traveled through there in 1971, just a little aside. It was one of the safest, most beautiful countries to travel through. I traveled from Pakistan to England, 3,000 miles or 6,000 miles in 1929 Bentley. And going through that Afghanistan, going into Afghanistan now, completely different worlds. Kabul now is a metropolis. And all the other cities are now huge. And the women are educated, the youth are educated. For those who think that the Taliban might stage a resurgence and take over Kabul, my answer is no. Very simple. The Afghans will not allow it. And it doesn't serve Pakistan. Because if the Taliban take over Kabul, there will be reverse sanctuary for the Pakistani Taliban. And Pakistan, which has an internal Taliban insurgency and a Punjabi Taliban insurgency and militancy, is going to be fighting internal wars for the next 25 years. That's the danger. And I think people are gradually starting to realize it in the neighborhood. I mentioned China. I think it's important to realize that China has come in under our security umbrella into Afghanistan. They bought huge copper mines. So did India. But the Chinese are trying to build a railway and other links so that they can extract that, take it back to China. They now have to be made a partner in the post-2014 transition because they will need to invest in the security and stability of Afghanistan. And the fact that Pakistan and China have an old and stable friendship and a relationship is going to be an asset. Now, on Pakistan, for those that are familiar with economic terms, there is this phrase called Dutch disease. When a country receives a windfall of natural resources so much that it creates a problem for itself. And in Pakistan, the Dutch disease stems from its strategic location. Because of where it is, it has an ability to draw the interest of major powers that are willing to give it money in order to keep it stable. Pakistan has to be smart about how it plays this card, because it must realize that its strength is internal. Its strength is going to be economic. Its strength is going to be its population and its youth. A country of 200 million with a median age of 22, so 100 million below the age of 22, they have to educate them, prepare them for the new world. Next door in India, 1.2 billion population, median age 26. Until recently, the cabinet in India had an average age of 65. So I belong in that group, and I can tell you that it's not easy for somebody at 65 to think about the needs of somebody below 26. So there needs to be a change in the political system and the political structure in these countries. They can talk to each other, remove the obstacles of the past, leap over history, and then go forward. I'll throw out a few numbers to you, and then I'm sure in the conversation more questions will be asked about how to stabilize the region. We've done a lot of work on trade, and so and as I said, on water between India and Pakistan, and I talk about this pairing because it has a huge effect on Afghanistan. India and Pakistan have a trade today of about $2 billion officially. It is estimated that another $2 billion are smuggled across their common boundary, because it's a huge boundary and you can't seal it off. And another $3 to $4 billion come indirectly through Singapore and through Dubai. But if they were to open their trade and bring it back to the level that the parts that are now India and Pakistan used to trade when they became independent in 1947, which was about 70% of their trade was with each other, you would have an annual trade rising from that official $2 billion to somewhere between $43 and $100 billion. And what that would do, according to one calculation, is increase per capita income in Pakistan by $875, and in India by $1,240 or $1,243 or something like that. That's huge. It would change people's lives. But more important, it would get people moving across the border, being able to see each other as human beings rather than the other, the enemy, and bringing them together. And even more important for Afghanistan, which is the transition we need to be worried about because we own it, we own the problem, is it opens the possibility of trade to Afghanistan and beyond, and from Central Asia through Afghanistan and Pakistan into India. The possibility of hydroelectricity power coming from Kyrgyz Republic and Tajikistan under the World Bank-sponsored CASA 1000 initiative is there. Afghanistan would profit, Pakistan would profit, India would profit, because India will need energy to compete with China. The TAPI pipeline, Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, that goes through, all the countries benefit. The Iran-Pakistan-India pipeline, once we have better relations with Iran, we remove sanctions about trade within the region, the Indians profit, the Pakistanis profit, the Iranians have a stable relationship with the neighborhood. So these are all the possibilities. And when I look to the future, despite all the troubles in the region, despite the possibility that there may be some sporadic violence, despite the possibility that in Afghanistan someone will try and rig the elections in one province or one city or the other, I think the big winners are going to be the Afghan people first and then the people of the region. And it's for us to be prepared for that and not to worry too much about how many people we'll have there militarily, when the BSA, the bilateral security agreement, will be signed or if it'll be signed, etc. I think we've invested a lot, and the ordinary people in the region certainly understand that investment. We just have to win the ideas battle and stay the course so that we're not like that river that changes course every 4 years. I would have said every 2 years, because we have congressional elections every 2 years. But, you know, General Ziaul-Huq was not a great student of history or politics. So unfortunately, he missed the target on that. I'm going to stop here because I know that your questions are going to be much more interesting than what I said. So be happy to take your questions and provide answers. Thank you.
All right, so if you'll, there are two microphones, so if you will step up to the microphones for your questions, we will alternate back and forth, and we'll start over here, sir.
Thank you. About 2 years ago, we had a speaker here who was a deputy director of the CIA, and he called Pakistan the most dangerous country in the world. Okay. Some of the reasons he cited for that was because of their nuclear arms. There was question of the certainty of control, the infiltration of the Taliban into their security force or security system, the loss of face of the Osama bin Laden capture, and if I can add on a few things over there, a lot of terrorist plots have emanated from Pakistan. And the Muslim religion is not only a religion, it's also a political force. And I think if you put them all into the stew over here, I'd like to ask you, do you feel what he stated 2 years ago still holds today?
I would agree. I think potentially, yes, for most of the ingredients, except the last one that you cited. I think all religions, when they are misused, and when they are misconstrued for a political purpose, tend to be very dangerous. It's not just Islam. It happens in every single religion. The things that people do in the name of religion, which are acceptable to other people around them, would not be acceptable if they didn't use religious garb to cover it. So I would remove that. But potentially all those things, all those factors are huge, and they play a role. And they play a role not only for Pakistan, but for the region and for friends of Pakistan. So the Chinese are very concerned. When in Fatah, people from Xinjiang are finding refuge and being trained and go back and attack the Chinese state. The Afghans, as President Karzai has repeatedly said, our Indian neighbors to the east have the same complaint that the attack on Mumbai emanated from Pakistan. And because of the ineptness of the legal system, the inadequacy of the legal system, those people have not been brought to trial. The killers of Danny Pearl, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is now in U.S. custody, and he admitted to being the person that beheaded this wonderful young journalist. But the other people were convicted, and then those orders get overturned or stayed by different courts, and there's confusion about how the evidence was collected and so on. So it is a mess. But Bruce didn't mention the subtitle of my book, Crossed Swords, and I should mention it because I capture this in that. It's Crossed Swords, Pakistan, its army, and the wars within. So even though the book covers a lot of the external wars with India, it is really the wars within that Pakistan needs to fight and win. And it is not because Uncle Sam says so or the Chinese say so, or the Russians or the Saudis say so. It's because if there is to be a future for these 100 million Pakistanis who are below the age of 22, then as a society, there needs to be a decision made on what the future of Pakistan should be and what system it should have. The founder of Pakistan, Mr. Jinnah, was a Muslim. He created a place for Muslims to be together. But he also, in his very first speech to the Constituent Assembly, basically said words to the effect, from this day on, you can go to your mosques, you can go to your temples, you can go to your churches because you're all Pakistani. I think that was lost in the process of cycles of military rule and civilian corruption and feudalism. But that's changing, and I think with a middle class of 53 million, average per capita income of $10,000 under a purchasing power parity calculation, you have the possibility to do something big and change the economic and political map of the country. So I will continue to wear my optimistic hat and hope that the Pakistanis solve those problems for their own sake.
Over here, please.
Yeah, both Pakistan and India have nuclear capabilities, nuclear weapon capabilities, neither of whom would be willing to surrender those. How do you rank the chances of our success in getting the Iranians to ratchet down or to abandon their efforts toward nuclear capability? What more can be done besides the sanctions that are currently being applied?
Well, first off, the sanctions have been extremely successful. They've been successful because they've reduced the ability of Iran to function financially in the world outside. So they've been squeezed, and they have to make some choices. We've seen this in the behavior of the Iranian leadership. Anyone who delivers the United States to the people of Iran and who recreates that friendship is going to come out the big winner in Iranian politics. The reason is ordinary Iranians want a relationship with the United States. They always look back on the old days and they look back with a very romantic eye. They also look at the reality of the economic world that they live in. I mean, if they can't operate by trade even with their neighbors, Pakistan just had to abandon the plans for the Iran-Pakistan-India pipeline because they were worried about U.S. sanctions. So I think this is going to be a huge issue. Now, where do the Iranians stop? They will probably stop when they're given the right to enrich uranium under safeguards. And now I go back to my experience with the IAEA, 1998 to 2001. There were efforts made to get them to not only sign what's known as the additional protocol, which allows the IAEA to go in at will whenever they want to and go to any site and inspect it. Once that happens, then it's what Secretary George Shultz used to call trust but verify, the words that he put into President Reagan's mouth at Reykjavik with the Soviets. It's trust but verify. Once the Iranians realize that that's what's going to guide it, if they can process the uranium in order to use it for peaceful purposes up to a certain level, then they can't enrich it further. And you can't reverse that process once it's been done. I think that's when the possibility of Iran not being able to weaponize its uranium, enriched uranium stock, that will become a reality. But it'll be a gradual process. The fact that the Treasury has allowed now humanitarian assistance to go to Iran means that we can now start building that relationship with the people that are suffering, which is the ordinary people. My senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, Barbara Slavin, who has spoken here before you, Barbara's been going there regularly for us, and if all goes well, I'll be taking a team later this year to talk to people in the government and outside to see exactly where those red lines are, and then hopefully we can find a way to stop Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons.
Thank you very much for a very upbeat presentation. Can I bring up the darker side? Import or the transport of morphine or poppy seeds and things like that, and its influence on the so-called trade. And one other thing, you may or may not have read the recent article in the New York Times Magazine about the revelation about how Pakistan had protected bin Laden. Could you comment on those two things for me, please?
Certainly. I'm glad you asked both those questions because the flow of heroin particularly is a huge problem for the region, and it flows in different directions. One line goes through Iran, the other goes through Tajikistan into Central Asia, and then through Russia into Europe and the West, and also through Pakistan. Large elements of what we call the Taliban, we tend to group them under a single umbrella, in both Afghanistan and in Pakistan, are really criminals associated with this trade. They know how to make money, they want to protect their rights and control territories as a result of this, and so they're very much part of this. Interestingly, Iran has been one of the strongest partners in the fight against drug trafficking. And that's, for me, again, my optimistic hat on my head. I look at the possibility of working with Iran to see how we can actually seal that route off and then work with the Central Asian states to do the same and with Pakistan. Very interestingly, and I spent a lot of time traveling in that border region. I wrote a report on the counterinsurgency experience of the Pakistan Army, and so I traveled that region. And before that, for General Petraeus, I did a study on Fatah, the border region. And one of the things I found out was that the most successful poppy eradication program in the region was in Pakistan. Today, no poppy seeds are grown in Pakistan. Why? Because we had a very active and highly trained and skilled team, which is called the anti-narcotics section of the U.S. Embassy in Islamabad. These were people that knew the region, traveled in it, spoke the language, and worked with locals and found alternatives to poppy growing. And they basically built roads into the border region so that you could have commerce and trade and people could grow other things and take them to the market. And they eliminated the poppy seeds from Pakistan. But Afghanistan offered a haven, and different governments, including the Taliban, despite an initial ban on poppy, they basically looked the other way and said, so long as it's going outside the country, you can grow it. The trouble is, it doesn't just go outside the country. The biggest addicts are now in Afghanistan and Iran and in Pakistan, as well as in Central Asia. So that's the one issue. The other article that you're referring to, I saw that about 10 days ago first. It was by Carlotta Gall. And I know Carlotta and respect her greatly as a journalist. I think she's done some excellent reporting out of the region. She follows the footsteps of her father, whom I knew. Sandy Gall was a world-famous independent television correspondent in Britain. And he and I covered the India-Pakistan war in 1971 on the Western Front, so I knew him from then. And so I have no trouble with her reporting. You have to read her piece in the New York Times very carefully, though. She bases her claim on an unnamed inter-services intelligence officer talking to an unnamed U.S. officer that they had a self-standing autonomous section of the inter-services intelligence that was looking after bin Laden in the safe house in Abbottabad. There's been a very interesting riposte to that that's been published by Peter Bergen, a friend of mine who works at the New America Foundation and who was one of the last people to interview bin Laden on television for ABC. And Peter makes this point that all the conversations that any one of us has had with U.S. officials in the intelligence community and elsewhere don't point to this. In fact, Karen DeYoung of the Washington Post wrote a story fairly soon after the raid on Abbottabad saying the United States had done voice analysis of the telephone conversation when they called to inform the Army chief and the head of the ISI that U.S. forces had landed in Abbottabad and had killed and taken bin Laden away. And they, on the basis of those voice analyses, determined that they were completely surprised. They had no idea this guy was there. So if it was the secret, it would either be in the data that the U.S. collected from the site, and that hasn't come out, so we'll have to wait for that, or it would have to be somebody coming out in public and giving us the proof that this indeed happened. I think South Asia generally is a petri dish of conspiracy theories, and for those of us that cover the region, we can't resist being caught in those. But I have no doubt that the reporting that Carlotta did was superb, and my regard for her remains unshaken. Thank you.
Over here, please.
It was encouraging to hear you and your efforts to reach out and embrace and reduce mistrust. Is there a desire in Pakistan or the other countries that you mentioned to reach out to the Taliban in the same way and to integrate them into the political democratic process, to make them part of the country? Or is that too far? Has the damage that the Taliban has done, does that make it impossible?
Let me first be very clear. When we use the word Taliban, there's the Pakistani Taliban and there's the Afghan Taliban. In Pakistan, the civilian government began a process about 2 months ago to begin talks with the Taliban. And they put certain basic conditions on the talks, that these would be conducted under the constitution of Pakistan and that the Taliban would cease fire. And once they stopped their activities, then the government would realize that they're serious. The difficulty with that has been that the Taliban are not unified. This is a brand name under which operate something like 30 or 34 different groups. And they all have different interests. Some of them are pure criminals or smugglers. Some of them are local tribal groups that are wanting to seek local advantage. And so they really can't agree on a single track. And so even when the talks began, the attacks on soft targets in Pakistan continued. I think the fact that the government offered this means that the public will now see that you can't simply have talks, that they will allow some military action. But I believe that the way to resolve this is to change the landscape in which they operate. And since I've traveled in Fatah, I sat down with 23 tribal chiefs or maliks in North Waziristan in a room for the most part of a day to ask them what their thoughts were, what their needs were. And it's amazing. I won't recount the whole conversation. Three things. They wanted irrigation control so that when the rains came, which were very sparse, that they wouldn't flood their fields. They wanted improved primary health care so that they could control the health of their population and not take people when they were on their deathbed to the hospitals in the settled area of Pakistan where they would always die. So they associated hospitals with death. And the third thing was they wanted primary education, particularly for their girls. And so I said, girls? And they said, yes, because women control the household. And if they are educated, then our children will be better, they will be better educated, their health will be better, they can go and compete with the rest of the people in Pakistan. Pakistan has failed to give the people of Fatah their political and economic rights. It has failed to integrate them. It carried forward an anachronistic buffer zone policy of the British colonial system, which served a purpose. But if you go back into that history, you see every 10 years, roughly, there was an uprising. Somebody would pick up the banner of Islam, use it as a unifying force, and then the British army would go in on a punitive expedition, beat them down, and then pay them large money, and then for 10 years you had peace. I know that because my own grandfather fought in two successive Waziristan campaigns, in 1902 and 1908. And then he was sent to a place called Mesopotamia. You must all know about that place. It's been in the news recently. And he was wounded, came back, and they sent him to a place called Flanders in Belgium. And he survived and came back and died at the ripe old age of 45 of a heart attack. Interestingly, his son, my uncle, fought in the 1937 Waziristan campaign. So this is something governments have to realize. If you don't change the landscape, if you don't give people the opportunity, if you don't create the enabling environment for them to have a life that they can control, they can make their money, they can do things, make their decisions. If you make decisions for them, it's not going to work. That's the change. And I think it's possible.
Okay, last question over here, please.
You spoke of our presidential politics and the uncertainty every 4 years. Could you enlighten us further about some of your presidential politics? I find it so sad that Benazir Bhutto had to leave, that General Musharraf had to leave. They both felt very passionate about coming back to disastrous results. Could you explain a little further for us?
Certainly. I know General Musharraf. I certainly knew Benazir Bhutto, and we used to meet every time she came here. In fact, my last meeting with her was on the afternoon when she left for Pakistan via Dubai. We spent the whole afternoon at the Ritz-Carlton Cafe in Washington, having coffee and talking. And one of the things I said to her was that you need to protect yourself. But she was very fatalistic, and she thought that God would protect her. Well, God says that you have to help yourself. And I think, unfortunately, for her, it was not clear who was really going to kill her, whether it was the regime or whether their ineptitude would allow the other bad guys to kill her. But the sad thing is, she was killed, and it certainly upended Pakistani politics. General Musharraf, despite his initial good feelings and desire to do good, was still a usurper. He upended an elected prime minister who may have made a ham-handed attempt to remove him from power while he was on a flight from Sri Lanka to Karachi. But that doesn't warrant throwing out the prime minister and imposing essentially martial law and ruling the country as an army chief and president for well over 10 years. I met him last in December, and I think he certainly now regrets having gone back because he didn't have the base. His base was the military, and for those of you that have served in the military, you know that when you wear the uniform, that's when you get the loyalty of your troops. The day you take that uniform off, it's the next guy they salute. And he never understood that. Interestingly, the military told him not to come back, but he thought he had 800,000 Facebook followers. And I told him, I said, I follow you on Facebook too, but that's only to find out what you're up to. And so, you know, being a person with 800,000 Facebook followers doesn't translate into being elected prime minister. He didn't have a party worth the name. He didn't have a single person in any provincial assembly. And when we hosted him at the Atlantic Council, I explained this to him in the first question. I said, how can you be president of Pakistan? Because the president of Pakistan is elected through an indirect vote in which the electoral colleges, the provincial assembly members, and the National Assembly and the Senate members. And you don't have a single person in any of these bodies. And his answer was very glib. It was quoting Mao Zedong. Said, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first few steps. So I think the journey for Pakistan has begun, and they really need to complete that 1,000 miles as a 100-meter dash, because I keep coming back to those 100 million youth below the age of 22. They're not going away. But if you train them, if you equip them, as we are doing with the emerging leaders in Pakistan through our center, we find that they can change and they can have a huge effect which will transform their societies from within. That's where the future lies.
Thank you
so much.